Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
He looks determined without being ruthless. Something heroic in his manner. There's a courage about him. Doesn't look like a killer. Comes across so calm. Acts like he has a dream. Full of passion.
You don't trust me, huh?
Well, you know why.
I do. We're not supposed to trust anyone in our profession anyway.
Peace, 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 and welcome to The Rematch, which is part of the BasketballNews.com podcast network. On The Rematch, you'll hear in-depth interviews with notable names from all walks of life. Because sometimes the media just doesn't get it right. The Rematch is that second opportunity to clarify, put things in proper context, correct fake news or misreported controversy. The media still exists as the most powerful entity on earth because they control the minds of the masses. I'm Matan Thomas, and the full truth is what we are aiming to catch. Many media stories omit details that would dilute their clickbait roar, and that's why there's a need for the rematch. Today, I sat down with longtime sports analyst Rick Bucher, as we discussed in depth the strained relationship between current athletes and the media and what makes him different. We also discussed Brian Grant entrusting him to co-write his book Rebound, in which he chronicles his battle with Parkinson's disease. And we discussed if Damian Lillard should leave the Portland Trailblazers to get a championship. This was a great discussion. Hope you enjoy.
Rick Bucher, how you doing, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Mr. Thomas?
I'm good. You know, I appreciate you coming on the show, The Rematch, at basketballnews.com and Fly TV. I can give you a formal introduction. It's been like 20 years in the game. I mean, but you, ESPN and ESPN.com, you know, you were a writer with ESPN the magazine and a columnist with ESPN.com. And you joined Fox. You've been with the Bleacher Report, you know, Sirius XM. You co-hosted a weekly podcast with BJ Armstrong. I mean, you've done a lot, you know what I'm saying? We'd be here all day listing all your accolades.
Well, thank you. And thank you for limiting it to only 20 years. I've actually been around longer than that, but, you know, that makes me appear a little bit younger than I am. So I'm good with that. Anybody who thinks that I packed all that into 20 years. But,
No. It's been over 20 years. It's definitely been over 20 years. So there's a lot that I want to talk to you about. I saw that you co-wrote the book with Brian Grant, mm-hmm. and, you know, Rebound. And I just interviewed him. Tremendous interview, if you didn't get a chance to see it. And I first wanted to ask you, how did you all connect? How did he entrust you with a book, talking about his Parkinson's and talking about his battle with Parkinson's and his entire career, both on and off the court, and such personal. How did he entrust Rick Bucher with that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I sometimes think about it myself. I mean, truly honored that he did trust me. Part of it is because we knew each other for a long time, even not necessarily directly, but indirectly. I had a great respect for him as a player. Always kind of kept an eye out because we're both from Southern Ohio. He's from Georgetown, Ohio. He went to Xavier. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised in Cincinnati. And there aren't a whole lot of guys who come out of that part of the country, either to play hoops in the NBA or to cover it, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. So there was always that little bit of just geographical kinship, if you will, from the start. And then we had a couple one guy who's in the book, Brian Berger, who's a mutual friend, worked closely with Brian, and Brian Berger and I have worked together. And so we had a mutual friend, and ultimately, I mean, we crossed paths in the NBA and, you know, talked here and there, but it was more just a general kind of mutual respect for each other. And then when it came to his retirement, and I knew that he was dealing with Parkinson's before he announced it. I knew that through Brian.
Okay.
And when it came to announcing it, I was still at ESPN at the time. And Brian Berger said to Brian Grant, you know, what would you think about doing it with Rick? And because of that kind of established trust, he knew me better than anybody else in the media. He entrusted me with that. So I got ESPN to go up to his house in Portland, and we sat down and did an interview on air. And then I wrote a piece after the fact about that on ESPN.com. And, and I just, you know, that put my relationship with him on a different level. It wasn't like I just parachuted in and did the piece for ESPN. Like now I felt so privileged that he would trust me to make that announcement. And I think just physically being there, you know, he was so like, I could just tell like this was a really, I don't want to say traumatic thing, but a momentous thing for him to do.
Right.
And why he was doing it. Like because I didn't know how much he had been kind of hiding and denying the idea that he had Parkinson's.
Right.
Kind of found that out through the process of doing the book, but I knew that this was a huge step for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just stayed in touch with him, you know, wanted to see how he progressed and wanted to be involved in any way that I could. And we talked a lot about, you know, possibly writing a book over the years. It took quite a bit of time before he got to that point. Cause I didn't want to do, and you've probably read them, you know, there's plenty of athlete books out there.
Mm-hmm.
Guys just want to do a biography. They want to tell their story, but they don't really want to tell their story.
Right. Right.
They want to tell like a specially angled, let me tell you all the things that I feel good about, but not
all the good stuff. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I can appreciate that. Like, but I just, from the beginning, I said, Brian, if we're going to do a book that's going to be meaningful, you got to tell them everything.
Right.
And what the everything was really changed as I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of personal stuff that, whether it was the pain that he felt, and, you know, he was working with terminally ill kids and like having a game and leaving that with still ice bags wrapped around his knees to go see a kid. And then that kid, you know, ultimately dying, and what that was like for him. And like all of that to me, you know, the pain that he had with his rotator, tearing his rotator cuff, you know, right before he signed that big contract with Portland. Like there was so many things that he was fighting on his own that people didn't really know were going on. To me, that was the essence of the book, that he had all these things, he was fighting all these demons. And then he came through that all. And I think in part Parkinson's, which he looked at as this incredible curse, ultimately inspired him to get past all of that and like to appreciate the life that he had, as opposed to feeling like, God, why did all these things happen to me? And so I just thought that was a really valuable, inspirational story. And, you know, that Brian was willing to tell, like, take that leap of faith, right? Because It's like any of us, you know, we start thinking, okay, what's my mom going to think when she reads this, right?
Right.
And that'll get us to self-edit our story.
I mean, when I interviewed him, I told him, you know, I was really surprised that he opened up about certain things about his personal life, like with his wife.
Yep.
And with, you know, the reason why he got a divorce, because there was a large population, you know, of rumors that said that, you know, she left because he had Parkinson's. Right. So there's a lot of the player community, and myself was included, that didn't know her from a can of paint, but heard that and right. then had a certain feeling towards her because right. it was like, wait, she left right. because he had Parkinson's? How terrible is that? And right. that was the rumor. But he said, no, he wanted to set that all straight. I was like, yeah, that was amazing because you didn't have to say that. Like, you didn't right. have to put that in your book. And that was amazing that yeah. he did.
Well, and I, you know, honestly, I got to a point where I was writing the book and I said it to my wife. I go, you know what this is? And she's gotten to know Brian. He's been, you know, as we were working on the book, he came down and spent some time at the house. And mm-hmm. And so my family has got to know him. And I said to my wife, I said, you know what this really is? This is a love story. Mm-hmm. This ultimately, when I look at his inspiration for wanting to tell everything about his life,
right.
it was to set the record straight with Gina. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? I had the love of my life and I mm-hmm. kicked it to the curb.
Yep.
And like, there's all kinds of things that went on both sides. You know, any relationship that's good, it takes two people, and any relationship mm-hmm. that breaks down, it takes two people. Right. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to come clean about, like, this is what really happened. I'm the one ultimately who blew it. And, right. and how that inspires him to this day. Cause like after everything went south with Gina, you know, one of the most powerful things he said to me was, I've never cheated on anybody since. Mm. Like, you know,
yeah.
some people will have regrets, but they don't necessarily change their behavior. Right.
Right. right.
And you know, as a professional athlete with right. money in the bank, like the opportunity to mess around is mm-hmm. always there, right?
Yeah, but he didn't have to include any of that in this book.
No, like, he did not.
None of that topic had to be included, and it would have been, you know, nobody would have
right.
missed it.
Right.
Because they would have been focused on Parkinson's and his playing days and, you know what I mean? All of those things. So
yeah. No, I mean, so that's why I, again, like I'm so honored that he, because I was the one who said, look, you got to get honest. If you're pulling punches here,
right.
ultimately, not only I think is the audience going to know, or there's the potential of leaving questions like, okay, well, what about this? What about that?
Right.
But I felt like he wasn't going to feel fully satisfied with the book because mm-hmm. it wouldn't be the story in whole. And the other thing is that's the redeeming value of reading the book, because I think everybody can relate, right?
Right.
We all make mistakes. We all screw mm-hmm. up. It's a matter of what do we do with that? And for him to like totally catalog all the mistakes that he made and how he made them and mm-hmm. where he is now and how he, like how he brought his, I mean, again, like, His honesty with his kids,
mm-hmm.
like, look, you all are from different mothers. This right. is how it happened. Do you have any questions? Like,
yeah.
if he doesn't do that, then the kids don't have the relationship that they have.
Right.
And to me, that's where you're really like, it's one thing to say and do things in order to get the love from your kids, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
But that still has a self-interest in it. When you do it in order for them to love each other,
right?
Now you're doing something that is unconditional and doesn't bring you necessarily any reward except right. to see it,
right.
right? Right. And to me, that's really the you know the amazing part of what what Brian did. And Tanya, you guys know this, like he was doing so many things mm-hmm. behind the scenes mm-hmm. that he didn't necessarily want credit for, right? He wasn't seeking credit working with these kids. Mm-hmm. He felt like, there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, right. What's the difference between me and these kids?
You know, another thing that I was, surprised that he went into so much depth about was depression. And, depression is something that a lot of athletes kind of stay away from talking about. I mean, even now, you're just now starting to see a few athletes come out and say, that they're struggling with depression. Kevin Love is one of them. DeRozan is one of them. But then you see other athletes, they talk about depression and they get immediate backlash. Yeah. See what Naomi Osaka is going through right now. Were you surprised that he spent so much time being honest about his depression?
It's a good question. Ultimately, no, I'm not surprised because I feel like he got to a place where he recognized that depression was also a part of Parkinson's. And okay. So it kind of helped him understand why he went down that rabbit hole. And I mean, to be honest with you, he was still battling it as we wrote the book.
Right.
Like there were times where I could not get a hold of him for weeks at a time. Mm. And I knew, I just knew mm-hmm. that he was, he was hiding out and he was depressed. And like Rafael Sadiq, who did the foreword for the book and Brian Berger, like I knew people up in Portland. I'm in the Bay Area. So I wasn't there physically. But I would like call them and go, hey, somebody needs to go check on BG. Yeah. And because I can't get a hold of him. And they were like, we can't get a hold of him either.
Right.
And so I think in some ways, because he and I had forged this place where we were talking about everything, like when he would disappear, mm-hmm. I was able to say, hey, like, we're all worried about you when this happens mm-hmm. because he's also battled addiction. And so when you don't hear from somebody for a couple of weeks, you think right. he's going down that road.
Right.
And to be honest with you, at one point during the book, he did. Right. I mean, essentially relapsed. Mm-hmm. And so we went on this whole journey together through the course of the book. I mean, I kind of joke about it. In that my first book I did with Yao Ming, a guy who doesn't speak English. Like, what the mm-hmm. hell am I doing? Like, what can I set the bar higher in terms of telling somebody's story? And then the next one is with a guy who, is battling with addiction and depression and memory loss as a result of Parkinson's. Like,
right.
Could I find somebody who can just tell me their story and we don't have to like have all these hurdles that we have to cross? The beauty of it is it makes it richer when you do it, when you are able to get to the story.
Oh, definitely. But it's such a story that's inspirational for other people. And that's one of the things that I kept stressing when I interviewed him. I was like, do you know how inspirational this book is for everybody else that is battling anything? I was like, you're Brian Grant, you're an NBA player for a dozen years.
Yeah.
And everything and he was like, yeah, like even during the interview, he was like, yeah, these are my tremors. I hope you don't, I was like, it's fine. But he's still kind of self-conscious about it. And so I just kept saying do you understand how inspiring this story is? It really is an inspirational story.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that understanding that as he was telling his story, that he's still battling the not wanting to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And kind of pushing through that, believing that it's going to help somebody else.
Right.
I'm doing this because I hope that this affliction is going to help somebody else. So that was inspiring for me as we wrote the book as well. And, you know, that, so I'm glad that that comes through. And I know that every time somebody says that to him, it's one more kind mm-hmm. of confirmation that the book turned out to be what I hoped it would be.
Definitely. Definitely. So I got to ask you this. I know I asked it a little bit in the beginning. You know, it is a testament to you that he entrusted you with this book. And you used the word trust a lot when he was explaining. But the relationship between the media and athletes are sometimes a little bit complicated.
Sure.
Right? And, you know, I remember we was, you know, this is going back a few years. I was doing a panel discussion with the Players Tribune in New York. And I was on the panel discussion. There was Jay Williams was on it. We was talking about this topic, about how can the media improve the relationship and the trust with athletes. Do you remember that? That was a few years ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the media don't quite understand, or they pretend to not understand, why certain athletes will have a apprehension, a negative feeling towards them or something like that.
Yeah.
And so the reason why I kept asking, how did he entrust you with this and how did you build this relationship? It's almost like you can teach other media people how to actually build a relationship. What that entire panel was about, how do you get athletes to trust you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're talking about just from a standpoint of covering them, not entrusting them with a book about their personal life.
Right.
So that's why I keep asking, how were you able to really do that? And what advice would you give to other media people?
So the first lesson, it's funny that this happened actually with the Portland Trailblazers. And this was before Brian got there. I remember I just started out. You could actually go back to the beginning of my career covering the NBA. I covered the Warriors for the San Jose Mercury News. And I came in a year before Chris Webber showed up. Mm-hmm. And everybody had a relationship. All the other beat writers had a relationship with Don Nelson, who was both the GM and the head coach. Like, he ruled with an iron fist. And if you had to get along with Nelly, you basically had to cover the team the way Nelly thought you should cover the team if you were going to get anything done. Yeah. Well, I was the new kid on the block. And so I immediately, first of all, I'm competitive as hell. So I'm looking at that and going, well, they all have better relationships with Nelly. I'm never going to get around that curve, right?
Okay.
And so I'm going to build my relationship through the players. Mm-hmm. And so when C-Webb got drafted, there's two people that were at the airport when he flew into Oakland, me and a real estate agent that the team had sent to drive him around to look for a place to live.
Oh, interesting.
And I knew immediately, like, something was different here, because this was the first time that Nelly had a player that was wasn't coming in to become a star. He was already a star.
Right.
And that relationship was going to have to be different. And Nelly was not prepared for that.
Not at all.
And he didn't. And when I found out afterward, like, he didn't even want C-Webb. Like, he was talked into it, drafting him. And so I learned early on. So and then I was in Portland for a game, and I went up to talk to Buck Williams about something. Mm-hmm. I said, "You got a second before the game?" And he goes, "Yeah, I've heard about you. You're cool." I was like, "Oh, the players talk."
Of course.
The players like, they know. Like, and so I was like, you know what? I need to respect that, and I need to treat everybody with the idea that if I burn somebody, that's going to get around. And my job, as I saw it, was not to be judge and jury, but my job was to help people understand why guys did what they did. Because ultimately, I believe, like, nobody does something stupid or like it, there's always a reason. Like, you may disagree with the reason that they did it, but there's always a reason. Trying to think who the player was. Carlos Rogers was with the Warriors. And he got kicked out of a game, again, in Portland. I don't know why all roads lead to Portland. We were in Portland. Mm-hmm. End of the season. Warriors having one of their terrible seasons. He got kicked out of the game. And Bob Lanier was the coach. He was the interim coach. And he told me afterward, like, Carlos had gotten a call or something during the game that his dad or somebody in his family was at his house, like, breaking furniture, going crazy. And I was like, people just think Carlos is some off the rail dude. But I found out, you know, players may have great individual ability to do this one thing. It doesn't mean that they're not living human lives and don't have to deal with all this other stuff. In fact, it may even be amplified because you have a lot of money and you've risen to stardom and you don't know who to trust. And like guys' backgrounds, maybe, you know, they didn't have the two family home and the two car garage and all that. So they're like the challenge is there. And fans, by and large, don't want to hear that. They look at players. They go, you play on TV. You make millions of dollars. You get to play basketball. Your life is sweet. And I just knew, but again, sort of guys allowing me to be a peek behind the curtain, that wasn't the case at all. Like, more money, more problems. And so I always wanted to, tell that story, tell guys stories, what the challenges that they had. Now I will say, you know, the difficulty that I find today is that, and I don't know whether it's because of social media. I don't know whether the media has been taken over by so many members who, you know, when I came in, you were a beat guy. And you had to, there was certain protocol with how you covered a team. You didn't want to get sideways with a team or with a locker room because it was going to be really hard to cover that team or that, and you were there every day. Well, now you don't have those longstanding relationships. Like, people fly in, fly out. Some people are, you know, covering on TV. They're just... they're just putting stuff out there. It's not vetted. Like, there's no, and I don't want to say protecting the relationship. I think honoring the relationship. And I always felt like, you know what? Even if I have to report on bad news, if I give you an opportunity to share your side of it, and I tell the truth to the best of my ability, like, you may not like that it was written or reported, but it won't ruin the relationship. Like, you won't never talk to me again, because especially if I got to show up the next day and I show up the next day and I say, hey, like I give you the opportunity to, dude, I had a problem. Like, I thought you got this wrong or whatever. And we can talk it out. Like, knowing that I tried my best to get it right and that I'll fix it if honestly I did get it wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, I just don't think that happens anymore.
A lot of, and I'll say this, even back then, I could even go to from my playing days, it didn't happen a lot then. So you are different, and you do have to recognize why you're different. And the reason why you have the connection with players is because you do things that other media people do not do. A lot of times their allegiance is to the team. Their allegiance is to what the team, and you know, the team sometimes wants to put out certain notions about certain players and to manipulate certain situations. That's what they do. That's what they do.
Here's the thing. Like, people are always looking at, like, oh, these players are undisciplined. They do these crazy things. They got a lot of money. They just spent. Like, if we pulled the curtain on the owners,
they are
just as whack, if not more. Okay. Yeah. I mean, And the league is rife on every level with people who do, like, who get inside the NBA bubble, and they begin to think that life is different, and they can get away with stuff. Look, media people do it. Like, everybody, you get inside that bubble and you think the rules don't apply to me, and then every once in a while, real life intrudes. You go, oh, and that's what the world sees. Definitely. So you look like an idiot.
Right. Right. But also you the part about losing the trust with the players. And that's something that you've always valued. So even going back, because you mentioned Golden State and you mentioned Chris Webber. You had a good relationship with Chris Webber. Everybody knows that. You know, the players, we know that. We have heard that you've had a good relationship with him. How did you cultivate that relationship? Like, how did that work? Because I want different media people to look at this and see you talking about this and understand how it works. We had a whole panel discussion on this topic, and the media people that were in the audience, if you remember, they were clueless.
They had no idea.
And I was like, this isn't really hard to do. You just treat them like they're human beings and everything. But this is everything that you're saying. But how did you cultivate that relationship with Chris Webber?
So this is the tricky part, too, as I get into this, because as a media member, I have a job to do, which is to cover the team. So the idea of becoming friends, it's not that. You want to have a relationship. You want to have an honest relationship, a fair relationship. And so, how it started was, like, I knew the dynamics between Nelly and C-Web were going to be difficult. Okay. And especially when I heard that Nelly wanted C-Web to play center. And C-Web wanted to be the next Charles Barkley. If you remember at the time, like, the center position was dominated by big, accomplished, I mean, Shaq, Akeem, Patrick Ewing, like, and Webb's coming in at 6'9", 250, and he's like, I'm supposed to be rookie of the year. If I'm playing center,
right,
I could get embarrassed
right
on a nightly basis.
Right.
I want to play power forward. And so the first when he was the night he was drafted, Nelly said he's gonna play center. And we got C-Web on the speakerphone at the draft and to interview him. And I asked him, Nelly says you're gonna play center. How do you feel about that? And there was this like 4-second pause. And I went, oh my God, they never even told him. That was the plan. Yeah. Like, this is a 19-year-old kid coming out of the Fab Five, and you haven't even had this conversation, and I'm the one in the media who's breaking it to him that he's going to be playing the position he doesn't want to play.
Right.
Like, this is not good. So 2 weeks into the season, and again, this is where it's difficult to do what I was able to do then, because I was able to do the same thing with Kobe.
Right.
Is sit down and have like a one-on-one conversation with the notebook closed and the tape recorder off and just ask questions. And so I sat down with him 2 weeks into the season, and I said, like, how's it going? Like, playing center. And he says, if I'm not able to get protection from ownership from Nelly, I'm out of here at the end of the year. But you can't, like, you can't say that. You can't report that. You can't do anything with that. And I'm like, thanks a lot. The team just mortgaged its future to get you.
Right.
You have a 1 year out on your contract.
Yeah.
You're saying you're leaving at the end of the year, and I can't do anything with it. Like,
wow.
Thank you for putting that on my head.
Wow.
And so I said, okay. And I actually, like, when I very beginning of my career, I crossed paths with a baseball writer who I'd heard the story. Sandy Koufax told him, I think it was Sandy Koufax, told him at the beginning of the year, I'm retiring at the end of the year.
Okay.
And I'll let you write the story first, but you can't say anything. like for the entire year. So he carried it that entire year. So I knew, like, I was like, okay, it can be done.
Right.
But the distinction was, like, Sandy was going out and there wasn't any controversy. There wasn't any conflict. I knew there was conflict with Nelly and C-Web.
Right.
And so I went back to Webb and I said, I won't do anything with it unless it becomes evident that there is a problem.
Okay.
And then, like, if it becomes public that there is an issue between the two of you, then we have to have another conversation.
Okay.
And so in the meantime, like, so then there's a game in Charlotte. Webb tries to go behind his back on a fast break, turnover. Nelly pulls him. They bark at each other. Webb sits the last couple minutes of the game, which is like, he's being punished. Like, if you're trying to win the game, you're not sitting mm-hmm. him. You deal with it later. And so that was where, and everybody was like, oh, there's an issue. There might be an issue here. And I was like, damn right, there's an issue here. And so then I talked to a bunch of other players on the team about uh-huh. some of the stuff that I'd been hearing that had happened in practice between the two of them.
Okay.
And ultimately, like, I had this story of why it came to this blow up, because that was just the last straw there. Right. And so this is a much longer story than you ever expected, but
that's okay.
So I went to Nelly. I said, I know you said, because Nelly was saying there's no problem between me and Webb.
Okay.
I went to Nelly. I said, look, I know I've asked you this before, but I got to ask you, you know, one more time, you know, are there issues between you and Webb? And he was like, we were in Chicago. He was dismissive. And he was like, no, you know, there's no problems. Like, I don't even know why you're asking that question. I was like, okay. Cause I had this whole story. Like, right. I had everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the other beat writers, because we were going from Chicago to Cleveland, they spent the extra night in Chicago and were flying to Cleveland the next morning, day of game, getting mm-hmm. time for shoot around. I'm new on the beat. I'm like, no, I got to be around the team like all the time. If they're going to be in Cleveland, I got to be in Cleveland. So I flew that evening, afternoon, whatever, after practice in Chicago. Snowstorm hits. None of the other beat writers can get out. And my story hits about the problems between Webb and Nelly. And now mm-hmm. I'm not quoting Webb. But, and I had like all kinds of other players confirming mm-hmm. all of it. So it really didn't need to,
mm-hmm.
but I have essentially a source story that like pulls the curtain on everything that's going on and the possibility that he could leave at the end of the year.
Okay.
And I'm the only one, I'm the lone beat writer to meet with Nelly before the game in Cleveland.
Okay.
And he does his pregame, and I really don't have anything to ask him, mm-hmm. right? I'm, again, you got to show up. Somebody wants to say something to you. You got to show your face. Let them know you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You got an issue with me. Let's hash it out.
And this is after the story had come out.
The story had hit in the morning.
Okay, cool. All right.
And so he knows, everybody knows.
Yeah.
I walk out to the court and the team's warming up and Judd okay. Bushler sees me and goes, I'm not standing too close to you. There might be snipers in here. And so I sit down on the bench to watch guys warm up.
Uh-huh.
And I don't even know what to do with myself. I mean, the story's blowing up, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting there and Nelly comes out and sits next to me. And he says, I just want you to know, I think you're a piece of bleep. I think your newspaper is a piece of bleep. Don't ever call me again. Basically, you're dead to me.
Right. Wow.
And I was like, okay. Like, I mean, Nelly's a big dude. He's a big personality, and he like, and that was kind of my, you know, my baptism in covering the league, where you're gonna do a story, you're gonna do a big story like that. You know, not everybody's gonna love it, but like I went back over and over and over. I was like, you know what? I didn't do anything wrong. I gave him the opportunity to tell his side of it.
And he didn't.
And what I didn't know, and what I've since learned, is that there were like, everybody was watching me, and they watched me show up, and they watched me ask questions, and they watched me walk through that.
Okay.
And I had guys tell me after the fact how much they respected that. And so, you know, there's part of it, like, I just knew people are always watching, people are always paying attention.
Now how does C-Web react?
So, well, this is where I have a little bit of a problem with Web.
Okay.
Because Web denied that he knew anything about it.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, you hung me out to dry.
Okay.
Like, because now for the entire year, like, I knew how it was going to end. I knew he would, like, but now for the entire season, it's my word against Nelly's. I didn't know why, because I was a young dude. Like, I was having tremendous back issues as the season progressed. When I found out, it was the stress.
Yeah, it was stress.
I was carrying the stress because after the season, I went to Hawaii, and I was walking down the beach with my surfboard, and I realized that, you know what, like, 2% of the world even gives a rat's ass about Nelly or C-Web or this story or, like,
yeah,
you know, it and next day, like, back issues gone, everything, like, and it was a great lesson again, like, to keep things in context. Now, the reason this is what's difficult on a couple levels when it comes to, and again, you know, I think in some ways the issue has gone the other way with the media. It's either you have people taking shots from afar that don't have to be held accountable and that don't vet their work, like, don't want to go. Like, if I check this out, either one, it might not be accurate, or two, I might get beat and not be the first one out there. So let me just throw it out there. Yeah. And then if I have to correct after the fact, I will. I mean, that creates problems and a lack of trust.
Of course.
But then the flip side is, guys are now, like, they're creating relationships where they're creating relationships with agents and players where they're kowtowing to what they want, how they want it told. Mm-hmm. And so that they get it first. But it's not necessarily accurate, or, like, you're not serving both sides. That's the great challenge, is, as a media guy, to be fair to both sides. And the difficulty is that enough guys are either not, like, they're just taking shots from afar, or they're in bed with whoever they're covering. And so that hurts all of us in the media. That hurts anybody who's trying to do it in a fair and reputable way, because now, as an agent or a player, well, I can just forum shop. Oh, you're not going to tell the story the way I want it told. Well, I'll find a reporter who will. And anybody who, you know, you don't necessarily need to be with a big outlet to get the story out there. Right.
Yeah.
There's still people that they're doing it to the best of their ability, and it's not everybody. It's not just one camp or the other. There's still some really good people out there that are walking the line, but it has become, like, we've done it to ourselves. The media have done it to ourselves. Like, we've poisoned the water because we are no longer held accountable. And here's the big difference, Atan, is that, like, when I came up, I had an editor who would say, I had a copy editor, and then I had the big chief editor, and, like, anything that I reported, I would have to tell them first. This is what I've got. And they'd say, well, where did you get it? And have you, did you get it from two different places, two independent different places? Mm-hmm. And how solid is it? And because it was newspapers as opposed to online, you had like, you had time to vet it. Now everybody wants to, like, I could get beat. You know, somebody else could have the story first. And so now we're hedging bets and there's no oversight. Right. Somebody hears something, somebody gets something, they're tweeting it out right away.
But that's I think that's part of the problem right now, is that when people do that, especially if they go, you know, say they're thinking on the fly, they're on a show on ESPN, on FS1 or something like that, and they're talking and they just repeat something that they heard, or they say anonymous source told them this.
Yes.
And sometimes the anonymous source is incorrect.
Or even worse, they have an agenda.
Or they have an agenda.
Right.
So now, and this is something that's happened a little bit more now with social media, because guys have their own social media that they can go to and say, hey, what that reporter just said is not true.
Yes.
And guys are doing that more.
Yes.
You know, so when I was playing, you know, we didn't have social media. You know, so if you wanted to, you know, respond to a reporter, like I remember I would write an article in the Washington Post if a reporter said something, but nobody wants to do all of that. I was just writing, so that's just what I did here in DC.
Right.
But for the most part, the reaction of the media, a lot of people in the media, I don't want to say everyone, but a lot of people in the media, the reaction when they do get called out is almost to take offense that the player had the audacity to call them out, not that what they said was true.
Yeah.
And that hurts that trust, doesn't it? That hurts that relationship. That hurt. How is that player ever gonna, you know what I mean, trust this reporter to do anything with them moving forward?
It's the whole, I mean, think about what we're talking about. Like, all of it is, I'm gonna put something, you know, the reporter's gonna put something out in the media. I was going to say something on TV.
Right.
And then the player's going to respond on social media.
That's what they want. They want the response, right?
What's that?
They want the response, almost. Not the report of the network. Okay, let me just say, ESPN, they want that back and forth because that drums up ratings and that drums up that. This is my opinion. You can tell me if I'm wrong at any point. But they want that. They want to play. They want, and when Skip Bayless was on there and always talking about LeBron, they were like, please, LeBron, please respond to him. You know what I mean? When Stephen A. Smith was talking about, all the time with Kawhi Leonard, they were like, please, Kawhi, come on, respond. But they never did. But I think want them to respond so it could be a back and forth to drum up ratings. Do you agree with that, or am I off base?
You're 1,000% correct.
Okay.
Because if a player recognizes an individual, and this is the tricky part too, and this goes with social media in general, like you're inviting that person up onto your platform, and you basically are validating them in some way.
Yes.
I mean, you know, Stephen A. and Kevin Durant helped make Stephen A. Because he responded.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, he's on that. And you know, Stephen A, like, dog, don't come at my neck. Like, all right, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm old school. Like, shut up. Like, what is that? Right? That is so fake, tough guy. Like, what? Like, I mean, that is so far removed from what I think of. Even if you're a pundit on TV, and this is, again, this is kind of where I've evolved, you know, because I'm on TV more giving analysis and opinion than I am out there. And one of the reasons why I'm hoping to have something done where I'm going to get back to writing on a regular basis is because I do want to be out there and I do want to have those in-person interactions, because that's ultimately like the whole thing playing out. I'm going to say something on TV and then the player's going to come back and he's going to say something on social media. Like we're not creating anything here. Like that only keeps us farther apart.
Yeah.
And I still believe that, and I've always believed this, that the athletes, the players, and the media need, or maybe not need, but certainly should be helping each other. Mm-hmm. In that, because the league and the teams still to this day and forever, even with as much player empowerment as we have, mm-hmm. they still have all the control. Mm-hmm. They still have the greatest ability to influence how the story is told, how mm-hmm. players' stories are told. There are exceptions.
That's changing with social media, though. So guys can control their own narratives a little bit better with social media than, say, my generation was when we played.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. But there's still a difference between a player telling his story and a third person telling the story, because there's a validation that this is, like, there's always going to be that question. Okay, is the player telling his story? Is he shaping it? Just like we talked about the biographies, the player biographies, right? Is he really telling the whole story?
Okay, that's fair.
Well, when someone is, if you have that third person, if you have somebody, you know, mm-hmm. a media outlet who's saying this is the story, mm-hmm. it kind of gives it a built-in integrity and validation that the player can't quite reach. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, people look at The Last Dance, okay. right? Yeah. And I think it was tremendous, and it reminded great. Everyone who has made comparisons between LeBron and Michael Jordan. It's like, wait a minute. Like, yeah. I think the vast majority of them never saw Michael Jordan play. If you were around him on a daily basis the way I was, and you were around LeBron, and no offense to LeBron, I mean, I don't, this always becomes like taking away from one or the other. It's just like, those guys are not even, they're just different. They're completely different play. Michael Jordan was a killer every single day of every single minute. When I see, like, I'm at a shoot around and Scott Burrell said something that bothered Michael Jordan, and now he's going to take him down to the other end after shoot around and play one-on-one and kick his ass.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a different cat. And that was him all the time.
Do you think a better comparison would be MJ and Kobe, and then LeBron and Magic?
Yes.
I think that's the better comparison. Yes. This is my opinion.
Yes. But, no question.
Continue. Sorry.
No question. So, I don't know where did I start?
But we were talking about a lot. But we were talking about where how Jordan is with his competitiveness.
Oh yes, no, and with The Last Dance.
And with The Last Dance.
So one of the elements that I've heard people who don't fully buy into it is, well, Jordan was one of the co-producers. Like, Jordan had a certain amount of editorial control over The Last Dance. So there are people that look at it and say, well, this was kind of an infomercial for Jordan. Jordan got pissed that LeBron, when he came back from the 3-1 down, and now people are, he could be the greatest ever. Like, mm-hmm. that's when Jordan said, okay, let's do the doc. Let's do The Last Dance. Let's do the whole documentary. Mm-hmm. And so it undercuts the story just a little bit, because they feel like there's a vested interest in Jordan to tell the story a certain way.
I'll agree with that. But then you see somebody like Jermaine O'Neal when he produced The Malice at the Palace, and he used everybody's perspective. He interviewed fans. And I was like, I did not think he was going to interview Charlie Haddad, the dude that, you know what I mean, came onto the court, but he interviewed him. And then he wanted to interview the guy who threw the cup. I forgot his name. John, I think it is. He wanted to interview them, and he showed the police, and he showed all different. So I think if done correctly, then you could. But if done with a slant, then you're, you know, it's
agreed
it's, as anything
agreed.
Else. Right?
No, agreed. And again, like to me, you know what Germano did was is a lesson to how the media should do it.
I agree.
Right? Is give everybody an opportunity, but again,
but they don't always do that though. So that's
no.
Going back to you and how you forged this relationship with Brian Grant, with Chris Webber, where even though you did, you know, you'll tell it and he denied it, everything like that, y'all still had a good relationship. you know, which was the, you know, set around the league. You want to give other people the opportunity. So even in your writings, it's not like you're going to. So a lot of times what a lot of reporters do is they hear a story and they run with the story without ever getting the other person's perspective to include in the original story so that you don't have to go back and correct something, which most reporters don't do anyway.
Yes. Well, and that, so that's why for me, like I being a beat writer is the most thankless thing now. And again, this is where I have a little bit of sympathy, not a little, a lot of sympathy for beat writers, because they no longer have the same juice. Like it used to be, like as a beat writer, the flip side was you had to, like, you need to respect your relationships with the team that you covered and everybody involved in the organization. But you also were a powerful voice because you were the person who covered them on a regular basis. You were the go-to. Like, you wrote the game stories and there was one play, generally one place. Now there's so much aggregation and there's so many people in the media that are covering teams locally through blogs and all kinds of different, you know, mediums, that the beat writer doesn't have the same, quite the same standing as they once did. But, and they're dealing with a bunch of people who may tweet out something at any given time where their editor is going to go, how come you didn't have that? Or what is this? Or you got to chase this down. And so you're always in fear. Someone's going to put something out there before you did. And you're supposed to be the beat writer. You're supposed to, like, you're the one who's supposed to be breaking stuff, right?
But that's where it changes to TMZ and no longer, you know, the integrity of a beat writer to make sure that they get it correct.
Yes.
Before just being first.
100%. And so the problem is that the outlets are not protecting their medium. Like, they're not protecting their beat writers. They're not protecting the writers, because you need to be able to say, don't worry about getting it first. Get it right.
Okay.
And there aren't enough outlets that are taking that approach. Okay. They want it to be first. Okay. And including the biggest outlets. Right. It's honestly, it's what I love about working for Fox. And again, we're not a broadcast partner with the NBA. Mm-hmm. But Fox's approach is not like, and I think they've seen through it. Like, I mean, I see reporters who are getting, you know, hired and paid to tweet stuff out. I'm like, how's that helping the outlet? Like, I'm not going to read his stuff at a particular place. I'm not even going to watch his videos. Like, I'm getting everything I need from the tweet, right?
Yeah, but would you say that if they do tweet out things, so say you tweet out something about a criticism, and there's nothing wrong with being critical. You're critical of different, you know, players at one time and things like that. But then when you, not you personally, when a media person makes something personal, it's almost like they're trying to poke the bear, like trying to get the player to respond. And then if the player does respond, it's like everybody's happy. Case in point.
Well, you know how much Stephen A. makes, right?
Oh yeah, I know.
Like, so everybody is like, oh, well, that's how it's done. Like, and
but it's rewarded, and that's the problem.
I know. Trust me. I know that's one of those things where I was like, that's not why I came in. I came into the business to tell the story that if I didn't tell it, you wouldn't know about it. And, you know, whether it was, and this goes back to like telling the story of Jalen Rose with his dad, with his troubled relationship with his dad, or his dad not being in his life.
Right.
And I literally, I sat down with Jalen and I said, look, I know people have covered this before, but I want this to be like, I want to find a way to tell this story in a meaningful way. Mm. And he partnered with me on it. And what I found was he was living with a woman who had a son from a previous relationship. Okay. And Jalen realized, rather than trying to get a relationship with my dad, I'm going to forge a relationship with this kid. Because I can't control whether my dad's going to be involved in my life.
Right.
But I can control whether I'm going to be involved in this kid's life. And that's going to fill the hole for me, not by being the son, but by being the dad to a son who doesn't have a dad. Right.
Right.
Did a story with Steven Jackson on the malice and why he went into the stands. And what he told me that his brother got jumped and he wasn't there. And his brother ended up in the hospital and ended up dying, got hit from with a lead pipe from behind.
Oh, wow.
And he'd never forgiven himself for that. So when he saw Ron run into the stands, he's thinking, I'm not letting him go alone. So you may not agree with the fact that he went running into the stands, but now you understand why. Right. And you may have a little bit of a different feeling about Steven Jackson as a result of that. And when I had like Tim Duncan telling me Steven was the best teammate he'd ever had, I was like, okay, he's been painted as this villain.
Right.
You don't get to be Tim Duncan's best, you know, favorite teammate ever if you're a bad guy. I gotta resolve this conflict. I gotta tell that story. Now that's where I get my juice.
Right.
I will tell you, I'm getting paid. I'm good. I've had a nice career. I'm okay. Like,
I got you.
But I'm not making Stephen A. money.
Right.
You know, because that is not valued at the same level as I'm going to say something crazy. And if I can get somebody to respond to it, like I'm going to be the entertainer. Right.
And that's the downfall of media, in my opinion.
You're right. Because it kills the integrity. It kills the integrity of what we do. Like, oh, so this is just show.
Yeah.
Right.
It's performative.
Yeah. And look, I've been on TV enough. There is, you want to be entertaining. You want to be interesting, but I still, you know, what I try to keep in the back of my head is, would I say this if that person was in the room?
No. Well, that's
what would I say it if I had to see them the next day? And you know what? And I may be like, I don't know how they're going to react when I see them, but right. I still try to keep in mind, like, I want to have justification for why I'm saying what I'm saying. Yeah. So that if they come back at me and say, dude, why'd you say that? I would say, because of this. Like, this is, we may disagree, but I think my criticism was valid. And I still, like on TV, I still try to do the same thing. Like, explain why. Rather than judge, explain.
But there's nothing wrong with criticism, though. And there's nothing wrong with being critical of somebody's game if they're not. That's what, you know, you're paid to do. The problem is when it becomes personal. And certain people make it personal where they're personally attacked. Like, listen, I played with Kwame Brown, right, for you know, 2 years with the Washington Wizards. I was right there. I saw it. So when he finally blew up at Stephen A. Smith and to get banned, so went off on it. That was off of all these years of being quiet, pent up, where it was made personal. But it's just amazing to me how so many people in the media, if you're called out on it, they're either like, how dare you? You know what I mean? Or they don't say, okay, I was wrong. Yeah. Like, why is that hard to say? Like, I've seen, I have different relationships with different media people, but sometimes the media gets it wrong. And I've seen players say, okay, what you just reported was 100% incorrect. And then the media person says, well, wait, you can say it in a nicer tone to me. I'm like, nicer tone? You're saying something that's incorrect with him. Just say, I'm sorry, I got bad information and leave it at that. But now you're trying to defend yourself of being wrong in the first place and not like just, you know, correcting it. Just say you're sorry. Why is that so hard for so many media people to do?
Yeah.
I was wrong.
I don't know. I honestly don't know because I've done it. Like sometimes we don't get it right.
That's right.
Dude, I did it with Kobe. Honestly, I put something out there that I had heard, and he goes, that's not accurate. And I said, okay, I'll fix it. Right. Like, and even that's, you know, cause everybody hears the initial story. That's the problem. Even the apology, nobody sees it, you know? Right. So, or you've already, the first impression is the one, but I have to ask you, I'm glad you brought up Kwame Brown.
Okay.
Because for example, for me, you know, everybody was always killing Kwame, number one pick, didn't I'm like, the Wizards made him the number one pick. Okay. Yes. They're at least partly culpable for developing him. That's not all on him, right? Mm-hmm. You decided he was worthy of the number one pick. You have a certain responsibility to him to make that work. You can't kill you like I've that's always bothered me when people say, oh, that guy's a bust, or you know, Anthony Bennett or whatever. Look. Nobody held a gun to the Cleveland Cavaliers' head to make them make him the number one pick, right?
Right.
So it's not – yeah, it's on the player to make the most out of what they can be without question. But to say that they didn't live up to being the number one pick, they didn't choose to – they're happy they were, but they don't choose to be that. But this is what this is why I'm glad you brought up Kwame and Kwame Brown is – So I look at All the Smoke with Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson, and Kwame's feeling like you guys are doing me dirty.
Right.
Like you're acting like me.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what it was. That's it.
Right. And, and honestly, I feel like there are more and more players who are getting into the media.
And they become the media.
We're operating that way. It's like even on their own feeds. Like, they're not even getting paid by ESPN to clown other players. Like, they're just doing it on their own. And I'm like, okay, so – and I would venture to guess I don't really talk to a lot of other media people. I'm just and it's a fault of mine. Like, I see – beat writers and media people, they go out to dinner together and they do all that stuff. Like, I'm too competitive. Like, if we go out to dinner and we talk, like, I can't talk about what I know or like, I don't want to.
Right.
It's a character defect of mine, but.
No, I hear you.
But now I think some media people look at it and go, well, the players are killing each other. Like, why shouldn't I kill it? Like it opens the door for everybody not respecting relationships or telling the, you know, giving people a fair shake or whatever it is.
Well, I'll say this. I was glad that Kwame got everybody's attention. You know, I'm friends with Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson, have respect for both of them. And, you know, Kwame's my guy. It's been my guy since we played together. But that aside, if we're looking at the topic, I'm glad that he put everybody on notice that this isn't okay to do what was done to him. And he was a 18, 19-year-old kid and was just thrust into a situation where, to be honest, they wanted to protect MJ. That was honestly. So everything was Kwame's fault. Everything that was good that happened was all MJ. Anything that was bad has happened was all Kwame's fault. I was there, so I saw it. So it's not like I'm, you know, third person. I was literally sitting right there seeing the whole thing develop.
That happens in a lot of places.
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
In to varying degrees.
It definitely does. But I like the part that he talked about, and this is the part that you do, going back to you again, is you humanize players. And where you said, when I say this, If he was standing right here, or if I have to see him the next day, would I describe him in these terms? Or, you know, like when you said Stephen A. Smith, you know, don't come at my neck and all that stuff. You're like, come on, man. You know what I mean? Like would you treat somebody as a human being. And then when you criticize them or criticize their game, it's not personal. You're not belittling them. You're not demeaning them. You know what I mean? It's completely different things. But now, because of what gets clicks, because of what gets attention, is almost the opposite of demeaning and everything like that, and the performative and all that. And that's what, unfortunately, the media has become. And that's why, going back to the panel that I was on, where the young media people were saying, well, how do we get a relationship with players when we see this happening, right? But we see this being rewarded. And yep. talking about yep. Stephen A. Smith, and yep. he's rewarded for doing what he does. I was like, well, sometimes it's hard to have it both ways.
Yeah.
That's the honest. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So there's a couple things here. I mean, number one is that there used to be really defined lines. Mm-hmm. Like if you were a beat writer or you were a reporter, like that was your lane, right? And if you were on TV or you were an opinionist, pundit, whatever, like that was your lane. If you were a columnist, you know, you gave your opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And this happened with me at ESPN. You know, they blurred the lines. Mm-hmm. Now you're a reporter, but you're also being asked to give your opinion, mm-hmm. right? And so then it becomes kind of difficult. It's like, okay, well, are you reporting? Are you reporting something? Or are you just right. saying like what you think or how you feel about this situation? And so again, it's like we've lost the guardrails that make things clear. And so what happens is the public doesn't know how to take this. Or what lane, you know, what they're seeing. And to your point, like it works. I know there are people on TV who purposely do not go to games, or if they go to games, they never go in the locker room because they don't want to forge relationships. They don't want to have anything that might soften their ability to go like, I'm just gonna be strong one way or the other. I either love this guy or I hate this guy. And if you find out that, well, he's not everything you thought he was, well, then your love might be a little dissipated. And if you get to find out that he's a better dude or like there are extenuating circumstances, then you might not hate the dude the way. So for performative reasons, like, I don't want to know any of that. I want it to be black and white because you know why? Because black and white sells on TV. People, and you see it more in our society today than ever. People want to consume something that confirms what they already believe.
Right.
So if you're coming strong, if you're a pro LeBron guy, well, mm-hmm. I know you're a pro LeBron mm-hmm. guy, and I want to hear everything you have to say. And if you're an anti-LeBron guy, then I'm going to tune into you because you're going to confirm everything that I believe.
Right.
And so that's where we are. And it's not just with sports. I mean, it's society. In every walk of life and coverage. So it's, you know, and I wish I had an answer. I can just say, you know, for my sphere, mm-hmm. You know, it's like I can't solve the world's problems. I'm going to raise my kids a certain way. Okay. I'm going to treat the people around me a certain way, and I'm going to do this job a certain way and not look at what it might bring me in as far as monetarily or attention. Or, you know, visibility, mm-hmm. but, you know, I can sleep at night and I can feel like I'm, you know, I'm upholding my, you know, my principles. And I got to tell you, like, there's times where I'm like, he's making what?
Not all right. Like,
wait a minute. What?
Like, but you have integrity and you look at guys as human beings and you value them as human beings. So that's what has caused, going back to the beginning of Brian Grant and why he entrusted you with something so precious of a story is because of that integrity that you have. So it's hard. I'm sure it's hard when you see other guys making, you're like, wait, he makes how much? That's more than most guys in the league.
Yeah. But you are right. Like the gratification that I get mm-hmm. from being allowed to tell a story like Brian's and what that story then allows him to do and what it does for other people. Like, you can't put a price on that.
Right.
You know, definitely. And again, as I see it, like that is, that's an example that I'm setting for my kids.
Right.
And you know, that's the other part too, is like, you know, as you, when I was single and I'm covering the league and mm-hmm. like I could invest all my time in the relationships and covering the team and like consumed by that.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, I get married, I have kids and like my responsibilities shift and I still want to do this to the best of my ability, but I am now, beholden to other people and other things that are dear to me.
Right.
And so that kind of changes things too. But again, it also informs me, like when I think of guys that are parents and, you know, fathers mm-hmm. and they're in the league and I look at that and I look at the challenges of, you know, I mean, it's quite honestly, you know, I've been critical of LeBron with Bron, because everybody's like, oh, look at all the great things he's doing. And I'm like, God, that's such a tough place for Bron to be. I mean, like you know what I mean? And there's no right or wrong. LeBron's doing it to the best of his ability.
Yeah.
We like, I understand, like I want to do this for my kid.
Right.
And the toughest thing is to go, you know what? You're on your own. Like, or I got to let you do your own thing.
Yeah.
Right. Cause you, as a father, you know, you want to put everything on a plate, but I'm looking mm-hmm. at it and go, you know, the reason that my dad wasn't able to put a whole lot on the plate. Right.
Right.
And that's what allowed me to become
mm-hmm.
me. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, I say that having sent both of my kids to private school, I went to public school, like I'm guilty of it too, probably on some level. You know, we're all trying to hedge our bet and do it the best we can. So
right.
I try to keep that in mind when, like, I try to reference my personal experience
mm-hmm.
as a dad or as an athlete or whatever it is and put it in that context. And probably still don't get it right all the time, but
no,
I think at least trying to, right? Is what we're trying to do.
And when you in your coverage, you don't, it doesn't come across as I'm up here and I'm speaking about you down here. You know what I mean? You relate to them and like you said, you tie in personal things about yourself, and that's the reason why you have the reputation with the players that you have. I just wish that more of the media would see that and understand the value of it over what is being rewarded.
So here's the key. You know. But here's the key, Etan, is that the outlets that they work for have to value that.
Yes. No, definitely agree.
So you have to give your reporter or your writer or your mm-hmm. person the leeway to build those relationships and mm-hmm. to take the time to get it right and not kill them for not being first.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, give them the avenue to build, to do it different.
I agree. 100%.
And it doesn't happen. And so, like, I feel like a lot of writers and reporters out there are victims of, and much like players with teams,
mm-hmm.
like, teams now more than ever. I often say, like, the most valuable resource a writer or media person can have is access.
Right.
And teams now keep players more at arm's length than ever before. So those relationships don't have an opportunity to happen.
That's true.
And the player is looked as being standoffish or diffident or disinterested. And I just, like, Once I'm able to sit down with a player mm-hmm. and they get to know me a little bit and I get to know them, everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
And the teams don't, like, the teams want so much control over the players and everything, how they're viewed. And they don't want those separate relationships
right.
because now that makes it more difficult for them to control the narrative.
Right. Right.
So,
Again,
it goes back to why I feel like the media and players, like, look, there's a value in us understanding each other. there's it, because we're both dealing with entities behind us, bigger mm-hmm. entities mm-hmm. that are sometimes feel like they're working against us mm-hmm. and working against us forging a relationship because that threatens them.
Yes, definitely agree. Definitely agree. So you've been great, really gracious with your time. I want to ask you one more question, one topic, and then I can stop it from there. I want to keep it in Portland since we're talking about Brian Grant, and I want to talk about Damian Lillard. And he's been a topic of conversation for many years now. But then again, of course, this year as well, as it is every year. But a lot of people are asking the question, should he leave or should he go? And or should he stay? And so, you know, people who say that he should go usually say the same few arguments. You know, they may say they question if he has enough help or if Portland is doing enough to get him the help that he needs. Or, you know, if he is, you know, the as good of enough of a superstar to be able to get them over the hump, you know, does he have what it takes? What do you think? I just want to get your opinion on the topic of should he go, should he stay? Does he owe it to himself to look at, see if he could get it done with like a different way? Like what does Rick Bucher think?
So I think Damian Lillard should do whatever he wants to do.
Okay.
I don't think there's a wrong, I mean, that's his choice, mm-hmm. right? And I think he's done everything in such a honest and open way with the Portland Trailblazers. He's been a model leader of the team. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think he owes them anything. That said, and this is where, you know, this is where it becomes difficult because Damian's my son's favorite player.
Okay.
I went up and had my son and got him a pass so he could walk around with me, and we're standing on the court talking to somebody from the Blazers, and Damian comes up and says hello. And cause he and I have known each other for a bit, introduces him to his son. I know that what that meant to my son was like blown away. I just got to meet my favorite player. Mm-hmm. So, and I just appreciate the way Damian has carried himself. I'm, you know, I play piano. I have a musical background. So the fact that he is so accomplished in two different disciplines, I respect the hell out of that. I so admire everything about him.
Okay.
That said, one of the reasons that the Blazers have not competed for a championship is Damian Lillard.
Meaning what?
Well, he's not Kevin Durant. He's not LeBron James. He's not Kawhi Leonard. Like, Damian has made the most out of what he is physically, but he's not a dominant two-way player the way those. I often compare him to Steph Curry. Like, okay. Steph, I don't know that Steph is winning championships if he doesn't have Klay in the backcourt next to him, or Draymond, or you know, the team around him. I think Steph is a tremendous leader, but I think he needed a big defensive two guard next to him, and a playmaker, and a small who can play big like Draymond. Like, I think all of that and the chemistry between those three of them, their personalities and their strengths and weaknesses as players, like, just fits perfectly. That's what made them a championship nucleus team.
Okay.
Damian needs that same thing, right? But he needs that same thing, and he needs a little bit more of it. Like, he needs to have the right team built around him, because he has certain weaknesses as the superstar of a team that KD and LeBron and Kawhi and guys who have been the catalyst of championship teams don't have. They can physically dominate their position at both ends of the floor. Damian Lillard cannot do that. So does he need the right team? Like, and is that reason to leave? Well, so here's, so he leaves. Is he guaranteed to have that team built around? I can tell you this, in Portland, they're trying to build that team around him. Neil Olshey is constantly making moves, trying to find that playmaking small forward. To me, that's the ultimate thing, piece that they need. To find, you know, mobile athletic bigs that can protect CJ and Damian on the backside. Like, they're trying to put it together in Portland that, as you know, is like not really a free agent destination. So you're going to have to trade or draft it. Damian knows that they are trying to build that thing around him. If he goes anyplace else, he's not guaranteed that. Like, he's probably going to join another star, but this is Philadelphia, for example, right? Well, are they going to be building that around Damian? Are they going to be building that around Joel Embiid?
All right, let me ask you this. So everything that you said, I understand it. But let me go back, because, like, as you said, that one of your son's favorite players is Damian Lillard.
Yeah.
So one of my son's favorite players is Giannis. He loves KD. But they're all, he's that body type, long, skinny, you know what I mean? That, so he loves those two players.
Sure.
So I literally heard, and he literally heard, everything that you just said about Giannis before they won. Literally everything, almost verbatim.
But it's different.
What's different? The difference?
Because
they were one player away. Now, I will say that I thought that the addition of the point guard with all the defense.
Oh, Drew Holiday.
The addition of Drew Holiday was huge for them. Agreed. I don't think they win the championship without Drew Holiday.
Agreed. So in both cases, you have a guy who has stayed to this point, right? And the team has tried to figure out how do we put the pieces around them. Okay. The great distinction I see, and again, this is why I have immense respect for Damian. I feel as if Damian is maximizing who and what he can be as a player. I looked at Giannis and I felt like, you know, everybody says they got to have more pieces around him. And Drew was a big piece. Mm-hmm. But the greatest development was Giannis. Giannis took a leap this year. And I saw it. It was why previous 2 years, he was not my MVP. He was not at the top of my ballot. This year, for the first time, I voted him as the MVP because I saw a guy who didn't just have the physical talent, but he was doing the things that an MVP needed to do. He was making plays for other people. He was making far better decisions. Offensively, he wasn't afraid to take the shots that needed to be taken in the mid-range. I don't care whether you make it or miss it. You know this. Like, there's a certain rhythm to the game. When you're open and you have that shot, you have to take it because everybody's reacting. Okay. I'm going to hit the boards because I think the ball's going up. Because he's got a shot. That's instinctive. If you don't take that shot and now you pass it, suddenly everything, everything stopped. Right. And now somebody's got to force a shot up. And now I'm like, wait, okay, is he going to get that shot off? Like, it screws up the whole rhythm of the game.
Okay.
Giannis started to understand that. Like, he had to get over, I don't know if I can make the shot or not, to, I got to shoot the shot and I got to learn how to make that shot. Right. At a higher percentage.
Right.
But again, you look at what you say. Giannis is, 6'10", 6'11", long, can dominate his position physically at both ends. So for me, it was just a matter of Giannis learning how to play the game physically, how to basically utilize the physical gifts that he has. Okay. I feel like Damian is – like whether it's the logo, you know, expanding his shooting range or just his ability to change speeds. Like, he's getting the most out of what a dude 6'2", you know, 190 pounds can get, right? I mean, there's just at some point when they put a 6'6 guy on you who can move just like you, that makes the game really challenging. Like, now how much can I do? How much can I mean, the great ones can still find a way to score, but can I score and get people involved, right? And can I defend at the other end to that level? That's where, like, I feel as if Damian would be best served by staying, because he knows that Portland is going, until he just can't play anymore, mm-hmm. they're going to try to reward him by building that team around him.
Okay.
He might find that championship someplace else, but all he has to do is, like, honestly, I mean, look at, like, Giannis doesn't have to do anything ever again, and he will be beloved in Milwaukee for the rest of his life.
That's true.
Yeah. I would say that Chris Paul in Phoenix, mm-hmm. getting them to the finals,
okay.
will be beloved there in a way that he wouldn't any place else.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's a matter of, like, what is it that you want? Do you just want the ring? Do you want to be able to put that on your resume? Or, and this is what comes, you know, I'll bring it full circle to Brian Grant. Like, Brian Grant never won a title, mm-hmm. but he will be forever beloved in Portland because of the battles with Karl Malone,
mm-hmm.
because, like, he didn't leave. Like, he went to Miami because Portland decided, we're going to put our chips on Rasheed and we're going to go in another direction.
Right.
Like, he had that connection in Sacramento, Portland, and Miami. Even though he played for three different teams, amazingly enough, he connected with every one of those fan bases.
That's right.
Because they knew his heart was in it with them. And that's what Damian has in Portland.
Okay.
And again, it's like doing the job a certain way. Like, there's, you can't put a price on that. Right?
That's fair. Yeah, I definitely understand that. And I, you know, he's somebody that everybody is rooting for. So everybody's trying to see the best way for him to get rewarded.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like they're criticizing him. Like, they're like saying, we want him to get to a good place or something like that. Because people have literally been rooting for him since high school, because he always took he didn't take the easy route. He didn't team up with the power team in high school. He didn't go to the big school for college. He always took the more difficult route. So people respect that, but they want him to be rewarded for it.
So that's the other part too, is I feel as if for him to leave and to leave in order to get a ring, like, that would contradict everything that Damian Lillard is about. And for a guy who's never been to the finals, and I think has only been to the Western Conference Finals once,
mm-hmm.
the deal that he has with Adidas, Hulu, like, his brand is amazing. And he's earned that because of how he's perceived and how he's carried himself and that loyalty that he has demonstrated. Mm-hmm. I think if he leaves just to go chase a ring, like, all that goes out the window.
That's a good point.
It's a little bit like, you know, it's like, I see the difference between John Stockton and Karl Malone.
Mm.
Like, John Stockton will be forever beloved in Utah. And I think Karl would have too, except he dipped to see if he could get that ring in LA. And that's where, you know, that's the last we saw of him. And so there's just, here's John and here's Karl. Still beloved for all that he did, but you know what?
Yeah.
You ducked out on us at the end.
I got you. That's a great point. Hey, well, listen, much respect to you. The book is called Rebound, co-wrote it with Brian Grant. It's a fantastic book, so definitely encourage everybody to go get it. And I hope I see you going back to regularly writing again, because way that you cover stuff, like I said, I wish that other media members would see how you can be critical of someone, how you can, you know, do your job, how you can criticize when you need to of a team, of a franchise, of a player, of everything like that. but still have the integrity to do it tastefully, to be able to get both sides, to be able to get everybody included, and to where it doesn't feel like you're attacking one person. So it's definitely an art to it. So much respect to you. Keep doing what you're doing. And thanks again for coming on the rematch.
Well, I want to say I have immense respect for you too, Etan, because you have moved into the media, and you haven't just moved into the media to be on TV or to, like, the fact that you write, the fact that you are trying to, like, you see a way in which you want to share stories and give people a platform in order to tell their stories. I think that's really not only admirable, but impressive. I talk about, you know, having two disciplines, being really good at two disciplines. And anybody who becomes a great athlete or a professional athlete, I don't think people understand how much you have to invest in that. That has to be the focus. And so to have a second career or to have a second profession in which you are outstanding in, that takes a tremendous amount of talent and discipline. So I've been watching you from afar and have been with great admiration. So wanted you to know that too.
I definitely appreciate that, those words. I definitely appreciate that. So, all right. Well, thanks again. Thanks again for coming on. Like I said, keep doing what you're doing and stay safe out there.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Rematch. You can find more episodes on basketballnews.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review. You can also find my articles on basketballnews.com, along with exclusive content from Kenyon Martin, James Posey, and more. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at EtanThomas36. Let me know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see as a guest. I would love your feedback.